Right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Jake, and thank you, Alex. And thank you all for joining me here today at the Reserve Bank and for everyone who's joining online as well. It's great to have you here. As Alex mentioned, my focus today is on the RBA's transition to a new regime for implementing monetary policy in Australia. To keep the cash rate near the Monetary Policy Board's target, the Reserve Bank sets terms on which banks can access exchange settlement balances or ES balances. Those are also known as reserves. They're a form of money that allow banks to settle payments with each other and manage their liquidity. So we can use different regimes to achieve the cash rate target, but they do have different implications for the liquidity available to the banking system. And as things stand, we're transitioning between two different regimes. So I'll start with some background. The regime we're leaving is that of high supply-driven reserves that reflect the bank's policy responses to the pandemic. The RBA's bond purchases and term funding facility operations injected nearly $500 billion of reserves into the banking system. And as a result of that, there was little incentive, or little need rather, for banks to lend with one another, to make use of our regular liquidity operations. And the cash rate became anchored by the ES rate, the rate we pay on ES balances, which is linked closely to the cash rate target. The regime we're moving to is ample reserves. And in the Australian context, that means a demand-driven system for liquidity management. This is not about reaching any particular level of reserves. It's about a system which is flexible and can adapt and in that way steer short-term interest rates. The RBA chose this approach a couple of years ago in 2024, and that really reflected the lessons in terms of making liquidity more available, reserves more available to the system. Experience was that was good for transmission of monetary policy, it's good for stability of the financial system, it's good for efficiency of the payment system. So what we do in the new framework, we supply as much reserves as are demanded through our regular full allotment open market operations. Those supply reserves at a fixed spread above the ES rate, but we don't try and push more reserves into the system than is demanded at those operations and at that prevailing price. Last year we announced the details of those operations, including the spread of the OMO rate over the ES rate. So that's the backdrop. What I want to focus on today is the transition between these two regimes. As we move from a system in which the RBA has been determining the level of reserves in the system to one in which the banks will be determining the level of reserves in the system, how can that transition occur smoothly? How can it be adaptable? How can it adjust to market conditions along the way? Now, we're in the plumbing of the system here, but there's very practical implications of that. It's going to be important for the cash rate to remain at target. It's going to be important for markets to function well. So with that context, I'm going to focus on three particular issues up on the slide here. Firstly, how close are we today to a demand-driven system for reserves management, and what are we learning along the way? Secondly, how's our liquidity framework going to help with a smooth transition? I'll talk about the role of open market operations, the role of other liquidity operations that we can conduct, and also explain why we're announcing today that one of our facilities, Open Repo, is no longer needed in this regime. And thirdly, how should market participants prepare for a world in which liquidity management is going to become more active for everyone? So I do want to stress at the outset, none of these issues has any bearing on the stance of monetary policy, of course. As I said, the Monetary Policy Board sets the cash rate target in the normal way, and we can achieve that target under either regime and in the transition. Okay, so where are we today? What's our starting point here? Well, it is important to know if we're already in a demand-driven environment, if we're still transitioning towards that. The evidence so far is that we're not yet at that point. So we're looking at two particular signals, two things that should signal that we're getting closer to an ample demand-driven reserves type regime. The first is that interest rates in money markets should rise, and they'll be increasingly guided by the rate at which banks can obtain reserves, the OMO rate, rather than the return that banks get from holding reserves, which is our ES deposit rate. So that's, rates will still be consistent with the cash rate target because both the OMO and the ES rate are linked to that with a small spread, but the way in which those guide rates will shift over time. And then the second signal is that the banking system will determine the size of reserves in the system through our full allotment OMOs. So currently both these signals, you can think of them as a price signal and a quantity signal, if you like. Currently both of those signals suggest that we're not well, reserves are still above underlying demand. So I step through those. So this shows money market rates and the rates on our facilities, and you can see here reserves can still be sourced quite a bit more cheaply in short-term repo markets than they can from the RBA at our OMO rate. So it is true that money market rates have moved well above the ES rate. We see that across tenors, we see it across instruments, but liquidity is abundant and it's still placing downward pressure on those rates. And the second signal, in terms of looking at our use of our full allotment open market operations, well, that use is still pretty modest. You can see that in the orange line on the slide. We do see quite a wide range of counterparties coming in regularly. That's a good thing. And total usage has picked up a bit recently. But basically here, the banking system has allowed reserves in the system to decline rather than trying to offset that through open market operations. So if you take those things together, it suggests we're not yet in an environment where demand for reserves is driving the level of reserves in the system. So we haven't reached ample, but we are learning more about underlying demand for reserves on the way. So what we've learned is that the reserves that banks expect to hold once they're at ample, that's fallen quite a bit over time. So the way we gauge that, and just to sort of get a sense of how demand for reserves is evolving, we survey the banks regularly and we ask them what's their preferred level of reserve holdings in the ample regime. And you can see the results from that survey in the grey area on the chart here. So a couple of years ago, 2024, the banks' responses there implied that underlying demand for reserves was probably going to be in the region of about 100 to 200 billion. What we've seen in the most recent survey is that's declined to about 70 to 100 billion. So it's still a substantial volume of reserves, but that's nearly halved from a couple of years ago. It's also well below the current level of reserves in the system, which helps explain why we haven't seen more of a reaction so far in terms of market pricing or use of our open market operations. So that decline in expected reserve holdings, if anything, that's a welcome development. And I say that because one factor is likely to be comfort with the liquidity regime. As I said, ample's not about targeting any particular quantity of reserves in the system. We don't have a quantity target here. It's about making them available in whatever size the system needs. But it's important that size reflects comfort with using our facilities. And so that's what we've seen so far. So this chart here shows banks' high-quality liquid assets. And what we've seen is that the decline in the supply of reserves, which you can see in the red area there shrinking on the chart, banks have been comfortable shifting instead into high-quality liquid securities. So you've seen an increase in that light blue area. So what this tells us, reserves are the most liquid asset in the system. They are there to be held for this purpose. But at the same time, banks are comfortable that they can readily turn securities, monetize securities either in markets or at our operations when they need to. We've emphasized those facilities are available. They're there to be used if it makes sense to do so. And it probably helps that OMO's been quite routine still through the period of excess reserves. And so it's remained a normal thing to use. So we can see here banks are thinking actively about their optimal liquidity, and that's a good thing. Some of that decline might also reflect a change in incentives. So as I said, last year we increased the cost of obtaining reserves from OMOs. That was to encourage some greater activity or make sure of greater activity in markets as we do get to ample. So that may have had some effect on relative demand here, but when we speak to the banks and the results of the survey suggests that's not as important a factor in what's going on here. The broader point to make here, so we've seen demand shifting. I think that really highlights that what we need to be ready for is a range of scenarios for where reserve demand might actually settle. And that's at the heart of the system. This is quite an important point. And you can see this from the international experience on this chart as well. You can see this is the level of reserves relative to banking system assets in a range of other advanced economies. And what we've seen is that underlying demand for reserves has been difficult to predict across these other economies, and it's varied a lot. There's very different experience across different countries. So there's a bunch of reasons probably for those differences. You get some quite different financial systems here, and the inherent liquidity risks in those financial systems can differ, so that's that's part of the reason. There's also different operating regimes for liquidity, so that's probably part of the reason as well. It probably helps that our shorter experience with excess reserves, well, our experience has been shorter when you compare to many other advanced economies, it's been much longer there, and so that's probably helped to avoid some of the reliance on large reserve buffers that we've seen in some economies. But the point here, demand's hard to predict. It's uncertain, it's evolving. And if we look ahead, I think that tells a similar story in terms of what might change in the next few years. Well, we know demand for reserves is affected by innovation in the payment system, regulation of prudential requirements on liquidity, shape of the yield curve. All of those things are going to change. They could change in different directions. They could change in either direction. So we are just in an inherently uncertain environment there. So what's the takeaway from all of that? Well, when we get to ample reserves, it remains highly uncertain. I think just taking you back to the earlier chart here, it could be a few years away before we're really at underlying demand, and that's what the latest results of the survey would suggest, and that would particularly be the case if banks continue to adjusting to a lower liquidity environment. But it could also be much sooner, particularly if we see these other factors pushing up reserve demand, or if we start hitting certain frictions in markets, in the distribution of reserves, then we could actually be hitting ample reserves much, much sooner. So that's all to really set, you know, set up the background for the framework, because the framework, whatever happens, the framework is set up to be able to provide reserves in whatever level of demand or whatever timing eventually emerges. So it's that flexibility that's at the heart of the framework. So I'll get into that now in terms of the framework. So how is the framework designed to smoothly adjust to reserves demand as we get closer? And that's going to be important for keeping the cash rate at target as reserves drain, to make sure that the liquidity in the system's in balance. So this graph here illustrates the transition, and I'll step through what's going to happen. So as our bond holdings keep maturing, that's going to by itself reduce system liquidity, drain system liquidity at the rate of about $20 to $40 billion a year. But as reserves get to underlying demand, which is the area in grey here, what's going to happen is we'll see banks will try and offset that. Banks will have an incentive to offset that by accessing our open market operations and replace those drained reserves through OMOs. So that's going to keep the overall level of reserves in the system consistent with demand. In essence, what's going to happen here is that demand, well, the supply of liquidity is going to be driven by demand from the banks at this point. So rather than our earlier decisions about our assets driving reserves, it's going to be the other way around. Demand for reserves is going to drive our asset holdings, given that short-term repo is an asset for us. So there's two important implications there that I want to emphasise, which are at the heart of the framework. First thing is that we don't need to accurately predict at any point underlying demand for reserves for there to be an effective transition. The system's designed to do that more or less automatically. So if system reserves drop below the level of underlying demand, there'd be upward pressure on market rates, there'd be an incentive to come into OMO and obtain that liquidity. So demand for reserves automatically generates in a timely way the supply that's needed. The second implication from this is our balance sheet can keep normalising. So as our bonds continue to mature, that can continue uninterrupted at the point that we reach underlying demand. That hasn't been the experience of some other central banks. So we can continue to normalise the balance sheet. The level will become responsive to demand, but the composition can keep shifting from longer-term bonds through to shorter-term OMOs. So in short, we don't need to know the unknowable or make any active decisions along the way for a smooth transition. So that's the role of our OMOs, and they are going to be the key liquidity tool, but they won't be the only liquidity tool, and so I want to spend a bit of time talking about our other operations. OMOs, they're going to be the key liquidity tool, but we don't want them to get to a size that inhibits the healthy functioning of the repo market. Now, to be clear, that might not become an issue. If we look at where we are today, OMOs can scale up quite significantly automatically from their size today. OMOs, our repo book, it's a lot smaller than it was prior to the pandemic. At the same time, we've had a doubling of the amount of collateral in the system. We've had a deepening, a strengthening of the private repo market. And actually, as our bonds mature, what that'll do is the bonds that we hold mature, that actually makes more bonds available to the market to bring to us as collateral. So it's quite possible in one scenario that we can meet system-wide demand for liquidity entirely through OMOs. That could be the case. But it's also possible that at some point there are issues in the market that the size of our OMOs inhibit the healthy functioning of the repo market because of encumbering collateral, and also because if it involves operational risks. So for those reasons, if you look at other central banks that have quite similar frameworks to us, and that's Bank of England, the RBNZ, the ECB, they're all considering a mix of operations in terms of how they implement policy. And so we're doing very much the same. For those who've been around for a little while, I think you'll immediately realize these are absolutely nothing new. If you look back at the period, a couple of decades before the pandemic that you see in this chart here, these other operations were an entirely routine part of how we managed liquidity. And in particular, the sorts of instruments we can use, that includes FX swaps, cross-currency basis swaps, purchases of short-term Australian government securities. That allow us to inject reserves in a range of other markets that are deep, they're liquid, the risks to us of doing that are quite low. So as I said, that's nothing new, you can see on this chart here. And if you go back to the early mid-2000s, there was even a period there where the FX swap book was bigger than the OMO book. And that's because we had a build-up of government deposits at that time, and to offset that, inject the liquidity, we needed to do that in a size that the repo market wasn't big enough to handle that. So there's plenty of history here. So this shows another scenario in which we do need to use other operations, showing them in red there. We build those up over time to inject further liquidity into the system. It's important to be really clear what the objective of these operations would be. I want to be really clear on this point. They would be aiming to supply a relatively stable quantity of liquidity to the system so that OMOs don't inhibit the healthy functioning of the repo market and to give us operational resilience. They would not be aiming to influence an interest rate in any of these other markets, in the FX swap market, CCBS, short-term Australian government securities. That's not the aim of those operations. And again, that's nothing new. That's exactly as we always did back in the prior history, that they were about a quantity, not a price. So to meet those objectives, if we do need to use these operations, we may not, but if we do, we'd be operating to meet three key objectives. First is that we'll keep OMOs as the key source of liquidity. It is important. We might use these other operations in size, but it is important that OMOs remain the marginal source of supply of reserves for the system. They respond to fluctuations in demand, that they're effectively what is keeping system liquidity in balance and keeping the cash rate at target. So that's the first thing. Second thing is we'll be a price taker in these markets, by which I mean we're going to transact at prevailing market rates in FX swap, CCBS, and short-term AGS markets. We would avoid transacting at rates that are inconsistent with our overall monetary policy implementation objectives, but we're going to be a price taker if we do these transactions. And the third thing is it'll be a gradual and steady approach. We'd probably start with FX swaps or CCBS, given that we've got a long-term bond portfolio today that's still going to be rolling down at the point that we get to ample. If they begin, we'll give appropriate transparency at that point in time, and we'll adjust the size and composition of these as conditions continue to evolve. So takeaway, these other operations are going to help us accommodate a wide range of scenarios for reserves demand and market functioning. All right, so let me turn to open repo then and why open repo is no longer needed. So the final element of our operational toolkit are the standing facilities. These are important because they provide liquidity between our weekly open market operations for short terms. But one of those standing facilities, open repo, that's no longer needed under the current liquidity regime. And that's because banks can readily get as much as they need in terms of reserves from our full allotment OMOs. If we rewind to when open repo was introduced in 2013 and what the circumstances were at the time, it was really to overcome the constraints of the scarce reserve system at that point in time. The aim was to give an extra source of liquidity so that banks could meet the minimum reserves they needed to hold to support after-hours payments. And at the time, we thought that was going to require about 20 to 30 billion of reserves in the system, and that was at a time when there was only about 1 billion of reserves in the entire system. So it was 20 to 30 times the liquidity that was in the system was going to be needed to support after-hours payments. So we needed another way of providing those reserves, and this was providing those at zero cost. In recent years, what we've seen with more liquidity in the system, that use of open repos declined significantly. And you can see that in the graph here, the red line. And much of that current use is now by banks that don't participate in after-hours payments, who were also given access at the time. So for those reasons, the banks decided that open repo is going to cease from early next year. We'll communicate more with everyone in the market about that in the coming months. And we would keep the ability to reintroduce the facility in the future if we needed to, if there was a strong case to do that. Okay, so lastly, how can market participants be prepared as we get closer to AMPL? Well, money market rates are likely to become more variable as we get closer. It's not going to be surprising if we start seeing some movement in various money market rates as we get closer. It won't be a surprise to us. It's a normal feature of an active market. It provides signals to the market in terms of liquidity provision. So we think rates will become more responsive to the level and to the distribution of reserves as we get closer, particularly in between our weekly OMOs. That sort of variation, that's been the common experience overseas. You look at the UK, New Zealand, Canada, similar transitions. They've very much seen that along the way. As we get closer and those signals play more of a role, market participants should be prepared to manage their liquidity positions more actively once again, if they're not already, haven't already done so. Being prepared means a few things. It means monitoring and forecasting your payments and liquidity needs. It means being ready to actively source and provide liquidity across a range of markets, and also having operational arrangements in place, and including calibrated counterparty limits to support that. And then the final thing is counterparties should be ready to use the full range of RBA facilities, drawing on those when they need, recycling from those facilities into the market, and regularly testing those. We did, and I do want to emphasise, our overnight and our intraday standing facilities, those remain very much open for business. We expect their use to rise further as reserves decline. And last year we made a joint statement with APRA to underscore that use of the overnight facility is seen as entirely routine liquidity management. And what we've seen, as you can see on the graph here, we've seen an encouraging lift in its use since that time. Okay, so let me conclude. The road to AMPL is a transition from a system in which the RBA has been determining the level of reserves in the system to one in which the banking system is going to. We're not there yet, and when we'll arrive is uncertain. Market signals are going to be the indication of when we're getting close, and if you look at those today, they suggest that we're not there yet. But fundamentally, reserve demand is uncertain. It can and it will evolve, so we need a flexible system. Our framework's designed to ensure that a smooth transition can happen, whatever the timing is of when we reach AMPL reserves. AMPL's not about a particular quantity. It's about a system that can flexibly supply what's needed, and in doing that, keep the cash rate close to target as liquidity is drained. Other liquidity tools are going to be available to provide a quantity of reserves if we need them to. Under that framework, open repo is no longer needed. It was really introduced to overcome the constraints of the scarce reserve system, but the other standing facilities remain very much open for business. And finally, market participants have a very important role to play. Active liquidity management is going to become more important. Participants should be prepared to deal with the full range of RBA operations, to recycle liquidity in markets, to monitor their needs. So flexible framework alongside well-prepared market participants mean that the transition to AMPL reserves can be a smooth one. So thanks for your time, and look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Dave. So we'd now like to invite some questions. For those in the room, we've got a couple of roaming mics, which we just ask you wait for those so the questions can come through on the live stream as well. For those online, we should have a QR code up on Slido. Please include your name. And please keep questions on today's topic. So I'll get the ball rolling. In your remarks, Dave, there was a lot of focus on the RBA's administered rates, specifically the OMO rate and the ES rate. What about the cash rate? Where does that fit under AMPL?
Sure. Well, I mean, the ultimate objective of this framework is keeping the cash rate close to the board's target. As I said, that's exactly how monetary policy is implemented. It is the objective of what we're trying to achieve here is to keep the cash rate close to target and for that to anchor other rates in the market. So in terms of where we are today, cash rate is back at the target, very close to the target. So you know, that's good in that it's achieving monetary control there. It's all consistent with the target. We've seen some improvement in activity. So it's now at the point where almost every day that's a market-determined rate, which wasn't the case a couple of years ago when there was a lot more liquidity in the system, there was a lot of expert judgment. So cash rate's near the target. It's a market-determined rate. It's not a great signal by itself of whether we're at AMPL yet. So we're looking at a broader suite of indicators there, and activity in the market is still hasn't broadened out all that much yet. So it's not suggesting that we're at AMPL yet. In terms of what we expect going forward, I think we expect there's, well, you know, it's more than likely that there'll be some more activity in that market as reserves drain. So we should see, you know, more banks getting to their preferred level of reserve holdings, more distribution of liquidity around the system, and should see more happening in that market. Now, it wouldn't be surprising if we do see the cash rate moving around a bit. That's a healthy thing. We've said this in the past. There's a strong convention for the cash rate to trade at the previous day's rate or at the target. But it is actually a sign of a healthy market if you get a bit of movement around. So if on the way there we see the cash rate moving around a bit, that's not going to be in and of itself an issue, and it could be a healthy thing. The framework should be there to prevent anything that's sort of more substantial than that happening. So if you saw pressure in that market, well, we've got our weekly operations where liquidity can come in. There's the overnight facility available every day. They're there to be used. So that should keep, while we might see some movement, that should basically keep the market in balance. Now, if we find over time, as we get closer, you know, we're still learning along the way. If we find that, you know, we need to adjust things because of the amount of movement in the market is beyond what we would want, or it's settling at a level that's more persistently not consistent with the target, then we can make these other technical adjustments. They'll be technical adjustments. They won't be a change in monetary policy. We're not planning on any of those today. It's more to say if we need to, then we can. So it's how the board sets the target, as it always has, and we've got a system that can help us to achieve it.
Do we have any questions in the room? Yes.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, David. Andrew Lilly from Barrenjoey. You mentioned in the speech that the use of alternative instruments to inject money into the system would not be based on trying to influence any prevailing market rate. You can imagine a scenario where intra-month, some key funding rates such as repo may be moving around with a volatility that is larger than the move of a cash rate increment of 25 basis points. Would it still remain true that you wouldn't use alternative monetary policy instruments with an aim of trying to smooth out some of the volatility in that rate in such a situation?
Yes, it would. You know, we will have a quantity in mind here that we're trying to inject. Now, as I said, we wouldn't want that to sort of be an issue with our other monetary policy implementation objectives. So that means we'll be mindful of market pricing. If rates are very low, then that does introduce financial risk for us. It might mean, you know, as we transact, that it's not helpful for the normal transmission to other market rates. And it's also when rates are very low that it's, that's a signal that part of the market's got quite a bit of liquidity at that time. So we wouldn't want, you know, we'll have a quantity in mind and we wouldn't want that to create issues along the way, but it's that quantity that we're aiming for. And so we're not going to be looking actively to smooth out any of those swings in markets. We're not targeting spreads. That's not what we're trying to do here. It is perfectly expected and actually what should happen, that you do get spreads between different markets because of different risk implications, collateral conditions, different frictions between markets. Those provide important signals to participants. They're an important function of those markets. We're not looking to target those. So it really is purely about the system needs a quantity of liquidity because it's being demanded in aggregate, and how do we get that out there? And we can spread that out across across different markets as we need to as well, just to make sure that, you know, we're not creating disruption along the way. So we're not targeting a price.
Thank you, David. Jack Chambers from ANZ. You talked in the speech a bit about the situation where eventually you may get more volatility or variability in money market rates between the weekly IMOs. Is there a scenario outside of an emergency where you'd increase the frequency of the IMOs if demand was sufficient, gets to a point where it's sufficiently high? Or would the preference be to change some of the administered rates to essentially encourage more market activity in the repo market?
Okay, so I think, well, question is, would we, as we get closer, contemplate more frequent operations in response to market conditions? We've set weekly, I mean, we're doing these weekly precisely to leave some space for the market. That's the point of having the weekly operations. We're not in there every day, quite intentionally, because then that you just don't have the same incentives or sort of space for the market to distribute liquidity. And as the, you know, the regime we're after here is providing liquidity as available, but leaving that space for the market to function. That's a good thing. So having those operations as weekly means that once a week, banks can get the liquidity they need planning for the week ahead. And if they need to, if it's economic to do so, they can also use the overnight facility in between. So they're sort of the guardrails for that. What would lead us to do something more frequent than that? It would need to be that we're seeing something that's persistently an issue with that setup. Now, as I said, we're probably going to have a bit of learning along the way. So it's not going to be, you know, if we see just some you know, temporary learning, something happens, you know, the Canadians have seen this, the UK have seen this, that, you know, the market is going to sort of discover a bit about the distribution of liquidity, distribution of collateral. If it's something that's temporary that the market resolves, then we're not going to be responding to that. It would have to be that there's something much more persistent that we're seeing over a longer period of time. We're saying this is really not consistent with the objectives of the framework. And that's probably going to be, you know, if you think about why you'd need to be in the market more frequently, it would be if there's a monetary control sort of issue and that you're seeing a movement in rates that is affecting the transmission of those rates. Not just, you know, moving in itself, it's because it's affecting the transmission of how those rates pass through the system. So it'd need to be something more persistent like that. It's, as you say, there's also the sort of more, you know, stress type conditions. And then in the past we always have, if there's a stress, if there's a shock hitting the system, we can respond very quickly to that. Drop of a hat, we can adjust our operations in response to that. But in the normal course, it's not the plan. We'd only adjust if there was something where our objectives weren't being achieved. And that's exactly why the message here is start getting ready. Because that's, you know, that's what we want to see.
Dave, we have a question on Slido. If a small foreign ADI needs to make a payment of $20 billion at noon on a certain day due to an M&A transaction, how are they going to source their funds?
Okay, so I think this is about intraday, really about intraday liquidity. I mean, the intraday facility is there. It's been there for a long time. It's been used throughout the period of excess reserves, which is quite interesting. We see today that volumes in intraday are still about 2 to 4 billion a day, and before the pandemic they were about 4 billion a day. So we're still seeing lots of use of intraday, even though we've got a lot of reserves in the system. And you know, we chat to people in the market, they tell us, well, it's convenient. And that's good. You know, it's there to be used. So it's exactly these sorts of things where there might be, you know, a large intraday requirement that banks should make use of intraday. That, you know, that facility is there to be used and nothing's changed on that front.
Any more questions in the room?
Thank you. Adam Donaldson, CBA. Your survey and the reduction in bank demand or requirements, can you just elaborate a little bit on what you think is behind that and what changes in behaviours you've observed, I guess, particularly perhaps since you changed the OMO rate, but how you think that's evolved to that much lower number?
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a good question. And, you know, it's very important to us to be speaking to the banks about this and sort of understand their thinking. As I said, not because we're targeting anything, but we do want to understand exactly those sorts of questions. I think what we've learnt is that just people are thinking about it a bit more carefully. And that's good, that when there were very high levels of excess reserves in the system, they have to be held somewhere. But as reserves are coming down, I think what we're seeing is there's thinking very carefully about, well, obviously there's a prudent level of reserves that needs to be held. That's up to banks to decide that. But then deploying those, thinking about, well, maybe we can sort of make these a bit more actively deployed, and thinking about the range of markets that reserves could be deployed into, comfortable holding, as I said, securities, because those can be monetized through markets or with us. So I think it's really just been a bit of a process of learning a bit more and spending a bit more time learning that, and being, I think, sort of mindful that, well, actually they're okay to be at a lower level of reserves than they thought maybe they were happy to be at once they've given that a bit of thought. It's not, I mean, in terms of the shift in the OMO rate, so we do ask people about that. The survey results have regulatory requirements, transactional needs as right up there, and the relative returns sort of secondary to that. So it's not, the survey overall suggests, yes, obviously, price has an effect on demand, but it's not as important as thinking about those factors. And similarly, when we ask them about it, it's factored into decision making, factored into thinking, but it's been more that, well, what are our transactional needs and our prudential needs, and how do we want to meet those in the most optimal way? That's more what we've seen. So when I say it's a welcome thing, to be clear, I think it's welcome because there's active thinking about it, because it's not just a sort of lazy, we don't want a kind of a lazy liquidity regime where it just sits there and isn't thought about. We want a regime where you're getting that balance between, you've got money in the system, that's a good thing, you've got healthy markets, that's a good thing as well. And so which requires that you don't have the lazy liquidity, it's that there's active thinking about it.
Thank you. I think there was another one here.
Thanks, David. Matt Squires from T-Corp. I'm just curious, I think in your remarks when you talked about the last year's adjustment in the OMO rate, you kind of had made the observation that potentially the OMO was inhibiting some of the functioning of the repo market, but it seems like contemplating the move to the ample regime, that if there was similar, I guess, impact on the repo market, you're now contemplating injecting liquidity via other mechanisms. Is that... can we infer that in that situation where there is increased demand from the banks for reserves, that an upward adjustment in the OMO rate going forward makes it harder to keep the overnight cash rate at target? Or, I guess, should we expect that it wouldn't be unreasonable at some point in time the OMO rate could adjust due to other reasons?
Okay, so I think you're asking if we're, and maybe this goes to the earlier question as well about adjusting the price and under what circumstances would we adjust the price?
Well, it sounds like from my perspective, last time there was some, the OMO was kind of observed to be impacting the operation of the repo market. The RBA responded by increasing the price of OMO. It seems like going forward, you're contemplating if the OMO was deemed to be inhibiting market function in repo, that you'd instead be injecting liquidity through FX and outright bond purchases rather than necessarily contemplating a further increase in the OMO rate?
I see, yes. Okay, thank you. No, good question. If I just go back to last year, it wasn't a concern that we were inhibiting the repo market at that point in time. What it's all been about is if we think forward to ample and we fully expect it'll be a good thing if we have a run-up in our OMO book, and just thinking ahead to that environment, how do we just make sure that there are appropriate incentives at that point in time for there to be an active market? Wasn't that we thought there were any sort of issues that we were trying to address at that point in time. It was really just, let's give this some, do some analysis and think about what we think the appropriate price is going to be at that point in time. So we've set it for that point in time. In terms of how that interacts with the use of the non-OMO tools. So the price, we've set the price based on our three objectives, which is we don't want too high a price, because as you say, then you'll get too much volatility in market rates. We don't want too low a price, because then we look at it as too cheap, we'll disintermediate markets, and too much activity go across our book, and we won't leave enough space for those markets. So we would adjust the price if we found down the track at Ample that we weren't achieving those things. But as you say, the non-OMO operations give us certainly a degree of space in terms of how much liquidity we can inject into the system without that necessarily causing issues of market function. Because we can, as I say, we expect to ramp up in the OMO book. We don't think there's any issues today with the size of our OMO book interfering with market function. The OMO book is historically at a low level. The market has grown. Our footprint in the market is really very, very modest these days. So there's lots of room for that scale up. But then we can use those other tools if we need to get an extra quantity of liquidity out there, which means that you wouldn't necessarily have to contemplate at that system whether you've got at that point whether you've got the right price on liquidity. But all of this, we've got a few different levers here, and I think it goes back to the earlier question as well. If the bottom line is we're not meeting our objectives, we can look across the different levers, be it the price terms, the non-price terms, the mix of operations, and say, well, what's the best way to adjust? And we'll do what sort of is appropriate for those circumstances.
We might just take one more question from online. Has the RBA considered facilitating the pre-positioning of collateral by ADIs and the automation of overnight repo transactions to support liquidity management for NPP and other out-of-hours or weekend payment flows?
Okay. Well, I mean, so pre-positioning is a big topic internationally at the moment. I think all central banks are thinking about this. It actually means a range of different things. What it really means is that, and in light of the experience of the speed of liquidity events that we saw with Credit Suisse a couple of years ago and others, that there's operational readiness to act quickly and to be able to use collateral quickly. Now, in the Australian system, this is not really about monetary policy implementation. This is more about, I think, into the realm of things like ELA. But you know, we've got self-securitizations, a key feature of the broader collateral that is available for things like ELA. And actually, when you think about pre-positioning, it's the having that collateral ready to go. And so that's the credit assessment, putting that in a vehicle, having it in Austraclear, and then it can be used relatively quickly. So when there's the extra question, are there steps beyond that in terms of legal transfer? I think that introduces questions of encumbrance and things like that. So we haven't really contemplated that sort of thing. I think we're comfortable and confident today that actually self-securitizations are quite a good vehicle for pre-positioning. But it's important for banks and others to be thinking and making sure that they've got the appropriate quantity of those ready to go. But that's really outside of monetary policy implementation. That's not the sort of collateral we're talking about here. In terms of automation of the overnight facility, it's not something I think that we've looked at this point. I guess we're open to a conversation on that if people think that's going to be a helpful thing, because we want to make sure that's as usable as possible. Hopefully people see, for our OMOs, we're using Tri-Party. We've just introduced a new system for more automated collateral management outside of Tri-Party, so we're looking at ways of making that seamless. So if there's a need for that in overnight, we're happy to have a conversation.
Thank you. I think we're running out of time here, so we'll have one last question. That was a cue.
Okay. Richard Salmon from Westpac. Yeah. In a previous speech, we've had discussions about whether the RBA may reduce increase the corridor and reduce the ES rate to potentially help banks or incentivise banks to recycle cash. Was there any discussion or further discussion around that?
So that goes back to my earlier point around the price. We've set that corridor. I mean, the key thing here, you can think of this as a fixed price system. We fix the price, which is the OMOES spread, and then the system chooses the quantity. The way we have set that price is to think about at ample, once we're at ample, what degree of monetary control do we think is appropriate? Because we don't want too low or too high a price for that. We could narrow it and we'd have more monetary control, but then we'd be providing liquidity more cheaply and that would not be good for private markets. So we're trying to find a balance there that is balancing both the needs for monetary control and the need for healthy private markets. So at this point, we're not seeing anything that would suggest there's issues with that price. Monetary control is operating well, cash rate's at the target, that's anchoring other rates in the economy effectively. We're seeing those all trading consistently. Our OMO book certainly is not at the point now where we're crowding out private markets. It's really very modest. So there's nothing today which is suggesting that there needs to be a recalibration. I know there's been some sort of speculation in the market as to whether we've got sort of a grand plan here as to, this was the first step in something else. That's not the case. This is, we have set a price that we think is going to be right at ample. And if we see down the track that we have persistent issues around either monetary control or market functioning that suggest the price isn't right, we'll adapt. We'll adapt to market conditions, but that's not where we are today.
Okay, well, if there are further questions, please reach out to the communications team via the website. A copy of the transcript from today's Q&A will be live on the website within 24 hours. And that concludes today's event. Thank you for attending, both in person and online. And for those of you here, we hope you can stick around for some light refreshments.
Thank you.